We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're joined by a timely duo. We're joined by Ryan Anderson, the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and also Alexandra DeSanctis of National Review. They have a new book coming out called Tearing Us Apart, Why Abortion Arms Everything and Solves Nothing. The book is going to be released when we expect sort of the actual decision in the Dobbs case to come out, or pretty close to when we expect that decision to come out. And we'd had this conversation with you guys about your book a few months back, but in light of what happened this week with the leaked Dobbs opinion from Justice Samuel Alito, I wanted to sort of pick your brains again. We had Josh Hammer on yesterday to talk sort of through some of the legal things. But welcome to both of you, and thank you so much for joining us again on this occasion.
Thanks, Emily.
Yeah, glad to be with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so the book, Tearing Us Apart, Why Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. We talked about the subtitle extensively last time, but before we dive into that, because I think the reaction to the leaked opinion from Justice Alito sort of opens up a conversation about that subtitle. But before we get to that, I just want to get each of your sort of immediate reactions. You've had a couple of days to digest it now, not quite 48 hours, but to digest what happened now. I'll start with you, Ryan. What was your first reaction to the leaked opinion?
To the leak or to the opinion?
On both levels, actually.
To the leak itself, this is just, it's unprecedented. It's never happened before. I would say every term of the court for the past decade, I have had close friends clerking on the Supreme Court. People who, like, I'm the godfather to their kids, they're the godparents to my kids, and they won't tell me a thing about what takes place there. I mean, that's how seriously they take the confidentiality requirement, that, you know, even behind closed doors, if they promised me to secrecy, they won't divulge anything. And so to have someone leak an actual draft of an opinion, not just, you know, discuss what took place, but actually to, you know, leak something like this is just, it's a huge betrayal of the confidence that's placed in them as either a clerk or a staffer or whatever. And it's just another sign of the corruption of our institutions. And I think it's really, really bad because, I mean, for better or worse, the Supreme Court was one of the few remaining American institutions that at least functioned. I mean, we might not always agree with the outcomes, but I think famously how Scalia and Ginsburg could be like best friends while still disagreeing. And, you know, they need to have that level of confidentiality to be able to hash out the issues, right? And so on that level, I was just shocked that, you know, the whole 98 page thing was leaked. The opinion itself, I think it's the best we could have hoped for given the current composition of the court and given what Mississippi asked them to do, right? Mississippi asked them to overturn Roe and Casey and to uphold their law. And that's exactly what the Alito opinion does. I know some people are saying it could have gone further. It could have reached 14th Amendment personhood stuff. I think that has to wait for, you know, another day at the court. I mean, I think for this case with these justices, this was the best we could have hoped for. And Alito's arguments, there's no response to them, right? The left, the pro-choice side has nothing they can say on the merits to what he argues in that draft opinion.
What about you, Alexandra?
Yeah, my reaction was similar. And I think, obviously it's unprecedented and lamentable that this came out. And I fear it's the kind of thing where the genie is not going to go back in the bottle, right? Everyone at the court from now on is going to be looking over their shoulder and wondering if this will be the next thing that rises to the level of a leak. And I find it very, you know, frustrating, obviously, just on an institutional level. But I think it's very indicative of what we've come to expect with abortion, which is for people who support legal abortion, anything goes, right? The end justifies the means. And no matter what you have to do to get what you want, I guess we don't know for sure who did this, but my hunch is it was almost certainly someone who fears that this will be the final opinion of the court and wanted to, you know, kind of throw a wrench in the gears or do whatever they could to either, you know, thwart that or somehow undermine it. And that's horrible, right? The idea, even if the ruling were going the opposite direction away, all three of us hope it wouldn't go. I would not condone someone on the right leaking this because that's just not how we would expect our institutions to function. So it's very disappointing. But like Ryan said, I hope that this will be the majority opinion. I really couldn't have envisioned anything better coming out of the court. So I'm just hopeful that it actually holds.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like the reactions from most conservative, most people in conservative legal circles to Alito's opinion itself has been overwhelmingly positive from what I've seen, just utter satisfaction with the way he arrived at the decision. Now, in the hours since the you know, not quite 48 hours since this leak, we've had people like Josh Hawley calling for calling for Justice Roberts to release the final decision as soon as possible. I think that's what he told Real Clear Politics yesterday. What do you guys think about that? Do you think it's important or even feasible to release this decision right now in early May? Do you think that's a good idea or a bad idea? And I'll come to you first, Alexandra.
I mean, I can see the case for it. And I think the most compelling case is now that it's out there that this might be what happens. There could be some crazy people who want to, you know, even go so far as to enact violence against one of the five who might be voting this way to try and stop it from happening. I think that's a fair case. But from my perspective, I think Roberts, at least in his initial statement, seems to be taking this tack of, look, we're going to proceed as if this hadn't happened, right? We're going to investigate it. But we're not going to let it affect the outcome. And it certainly shouldn't change how they were going to vote one way or another. I don't think they should allow it to change their normal course of affairs. So if it were me, I think the best judgment call is, you know, wait till whenever you were already going to do it, get your dissents lined up. And I think that probably would be the end of the term.
What do you think, Ryan?
I don't have a strong feeling either way. I mean, I can see the argument on both sides. The night when the leak took place, you know, Ed Whalen had tweeted out, Ed's, you know, our colleague at EPPC, and he had suggested the same thing as Hawley, saying, you know, look, now that it's been leaked, get the final version out as soon as possible. There's precedent in the Supreme Court where they would issue a ruling and then weeks later dissents would come out. And then weeks after that, the responses to the dissents would come out. There's no, you know, hard and fast rule that the, you know, majority opinion and the dissents and the response to dissents all has to be released at the same time. And that since the leaker had kind of accelerated the timeline, you know, no one should be switching votes in response to public opinion, but there is an argument to, you know, get the final draft published and make it official sooner rather than later. But I also can see the counter argument of don't let the leaker get any satisfaction. You know, don't change anything about what you were going to do in response to the leak. And that seems to be what the Chief Justice suggested yesterday in his statement, that, you know, nothing's going to change as a result of this, meaning both the final outcome of the cases and the procedure, you know, in terms of, you know, how they're going to release things. But I don't have strong feelings either way.
I want to ask both of you how a post-Roe world, if in fact this does come to pass, might change or might push the pro-life movement and the conservative movement to talk about abortion differently. Maybe it won't. Maybe both of you think that, you know, nothing needs to change necessarily in the way conservatives and pro-life people in general talk about the issue of abortion. But I know both of you put a lot of thought into this. In a post-Roe world, it seems to me conservatives are sort of pushed into really vigorously defending opposition to abortion in a different way. You can't have Republican candidates sort of leaning back on the settled law argument or anything like that anymore. How do you guys think that this will change? Or maybe you don't think it'll change, but what's your answer to that question of how this will affect the way that pro-life people talk about abortion? And I'll come to you first this time, Ryan.
I mean, so my basic thought on that is that it's an opportunity for a more holistic argument, which is what the pro-life movement has already been doing. But of necessity, we had to prioritize the Roe v. Wade aspect. With Roe gone, it now allows us to kind of do what Zan and I, you know, wanted to do with our book, which was to highlight, you know, abortion kills an unborn human being. That's the beginning of the harm that abortion causes. It also has harms for women, for families, for people who are already at the margins of life, for the medical profession, for our politics, for our law, for our culture. And this now gives, I think, pro-lifers more of an opportunity to highlight all of those harms. Also, now that the abortion issue will be back in the Democratic arena, it gives us a greater ability to craft policies that will address both, prohibitions on abortion, right? Prohibitions on abortionists killing unborn human beings, but also assistances, forms of assistance to mothers, to families, And the best example of this, the best recent example of this, which is also to highlight that this isn't the pro-life movement, you know, only now getting around to it. Think about Texas. Texas already had the Texas Alternatives to Abortion program. When they passed the fetal heartbeat bill, they added $100 million of additional funding that was allocated for the Texas Alternatives to Abortion program. And so, you know, so many of the criticism that I've seen on Twitter the past 48 hours have been that, oh, you pro-lifers, you only care about life when it's in the womb. Or, oh, pro-lifers, you don't do anything to assist mothers. Oh, pro-lifers, you know, it's like, no, that's not true. And, you know, at the civil society level, you know, groups like the Sisters of Life, entities like pregnancy resource centers, at the public policy level, things like the Texas Alternatives to Abortion program. Just, you know, last month, Governor Ron DeSantis signed into law, you know, the promoting fatherhood initiatives in Florida. There's a lot that I think social conservatives and just conservatives more broadly are doing right now to show that we are kind of both and. We care both about the baby and about the mother. We care both about life and in the womb and life outside of the womb. And so I don't think that's a change, but I think we get to, you know, in a post-Roe world, have greater ability to highlight that we've always been about both and.
What do you think, Alexandra? And I'll ask you, particularly in the context of Terry Moran's little meltdown on, ABC, just last night, when Mallory from SBA List was on his show, he was pressing her, if you believe that this is murder, do you believe this is murder? Then why won't you prosecute mothers if you truly believe abortion is murder? So going forward, I think that debate will sort of heat up, of course. I mean, that's always been present in the debate, but these questions are going to get asked more and more. So how do you sort of sense that these conversations will be affected and maybe the language might shift?
Yeah, I think things are going to change radically, and I think we can already see it happening. That example that you give is a very telling one to me, because of course the first thing abortion supporters want to talk about is to rush as far as they can to the other extreme and make pro-lifers look bad or push them in a way that tries to expose them as being, you know, evil or woman haters, because they don't want to talk about abortion, right? It's, they always have to go on offense so as not to have to defend their views. And Roe v. Wade has been a really handy way of doing that now for 50 years, right? And the two most common defenses of abortion or responses I hear from abortion supporters to pro-lifers are, first of all, you just hate women and want to control their bodies. Or second of all, Roe v. Wade is the settled law of the land. It's a constitutional right. Go away. Right. And that has been how they end the conversation. There's no conversation about what abortion is, why it should be, why it's moral, why it should be legal, whether there's a human being at stake, all these types of central questions that we might consider if we actually want to understand how to deal with this procedure as a, you know, humane and just society. They don't want to talk about those things. They just want to have these kind of nice little answers they give so they can get out of debate. And one of them is just pointing to Roe v. Wade. And so if Roe is in fact overturned, that defense is going to go out the window. They're not going to be able to point to that anymore. And they're going to have to actually turn to some form of debate over abortion, which is why you see these kind of outlandish comments like the one you referenced, or trying to put pro-lifers on the defensive. And so I think we have to be really prepared to have an actual conversation about abortion the way we've been trying to now for 50 years. And I hope in a way that we'll actually be able to. And a big part of that, Ryan and I are hoping, is this kind of language of, look, yes, of course, the fundamental harm, the chief harm of abortion is that it kills an innocent human being. But if that's true, and we know it is, how could that possibly be good for any of us? How could our society be better off for allowing that? How could women in need be better off for doing this to their own children? So I hope we see pro-lifers kind of learn to talk about the issue a bit more like that.
Mm. COVID broke the economy, and now a recession may be coming. A Federal Reserve survey broke some bad news, dating back to the 50s whenever inflation and unemployment have hit today's levels. History suggests a recession may be near. Remember what the last recession did to your retirement? It's so hard to forget. It seems like all of the time on this show, we're looking back at the aftermath of 08. So our friends at Lear Capital shared how investing in physical gold and precious metals can be a brilliant strategy against what's coming. Smart investors are buying gold gold and precious metals now for two reasons. One, gold can be a great hedge during a recession. And two, the closer a recession gets, the more your gold could be worth. Don't let your retirement take a hit like 08. Talk with the team at Lear Capital about owning precious metals for your savings and retirement accounts. Right now, you'll receive up to $10,000 in free bonus coins based on the value of gold coins you purchase. Visit LearFederalist.com. That's LearFederalist.com. LearFederalist.com. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And there's a sort of debate that's very much, I think, inside baseball and the pro-life movement about kind of incrementalism versus abolition. And this is an uncomfortable debate at times. But again, Roe has sort of given a unifying mantle for the pro-life movement to say, we really have to focus on Roe anyway at this point. And so now these questions about state laws are going to come front and center into full focus. The left is suddenly going to decide it loves federalism. But just more broadly, how would you sort of counsel Republican state legislators to approach this issue? Obviously, it depends on state to state, but how would you counsel them to sort of approach the issue of eliminating protections for abortion on that state level going forward? And again, Alexandra, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think incrementalism, the value of it, it's not kind of like a let's sit back on our haunches and kind of watch as the world goes by approach. It's very much a what is going to work practically speaking, at least in a legal sense, because we're talking about what state laws are going to be. And I think that just depends state to state, right? And something that can pass in one state won't in another. And lawmakers have to take that seriously. If every pro-life lawmaker in the country from, New York to Texas rushed to the floor with a total abortion ban with no exceptions, we're not going to get very far. And that doesn't mean that those laws aren't the most just and most moral option, which they are. But the process of getting them in place is going to look different in different states. And I don't think it's any kind of surrender posture or giving in posture to acknowledge that reality. It's important to be prudent about these things and take that seriously and push for the most protective pro-life laws we can get in any given state, while also taking seriously, the fact that public opinion is not totally with us. And we have to try and win people over and sort of meet them where they are and kind of get them, more and more on our side over time as much as we can.
Ryan, what are some of the laws that you see immediately coming into question in red states and purple states going forward?
Sure. So you can think of this roughly three buckets. And just for sake of ease, you can think one third, one third, one third. Unfortunately, about one third of the states already have laws that protect abortion, frequently abortion on demand. So even when Roe and Casey are gone, some of the largest, most populated blue states like Texas, Massachusetts, like New York, Massachusetts, California, Illinois, will unfortunately have abortion on demand. Some of the deepest red states, which is what your question gets at, have laws that will spring into effect that when Roe is gone, pro-life laws that are on the books will now be enforceable. So that's another third. And then a third of the states that'll be battlegrounds. And so I think what you're going to see in some of the red states that have those laws that will spring into effect is certain cities within those states that refuse to enforce the laws. So like the city of Austin might try to declare itself a sanctuary city against the rest of the state. You're going to see people traveling out of state for abortion tourism. And so I think already, I just saw this yesterday that someone in California was saying that, they should spend taxpayer money in California to bring people to California from red states seeking abortions. You're going to see mail order abortion pills, which are hugely problematic for a variety of reasons, but including, and this is what your question gets at, is that it would be undermining state laws if you could, purchase the abortion pill in California and have someone mail it to you in Texas, et cetera, et cetera. And then that third category that I mentioned, there are going to be states that are going to be battlegrounds. And that's where, what Zan was getting at. We have a sentence in the book that says incrementalism in abortion law must be in the service of the goal of full abolition. But, we're not going to be able to start with full abolition in certain swing states, certain purple states. We're going to have to start maybe with a 20-week bill, maybe a 15-week bill, a 12-week, 6-week. But we have to be clear when we talk about these things that, what the goal is full abolition. And then I think there's also going to be a role for the federal government in all of this. And unfortunately, I can't count to 60 on any of these bills on either side, either the pro-abortion laws or the pro-life laws. So long as the legislative filibuster is there, I don't see us getting to 60 legislatively. But I also think the agencies and the regulatory state will be hugely important. The next pro-life presidential administration that we have can do a lot through regulatory action, through agency action. Pro-lifers should be thinking about 2024 and what that will mean.
Are there some things, regulatory things or legislative things off the top of your head, Ryan, that you would tell a Republican president with both houses of Congress to pursue immediately?
Oh, sure. I mean, one would be, I mean, just go back to where we were pre-COVID with respect to abortion pills. It used to be that you couldn't receive a chemical abortion without visiting a doctor's office. Now it can all be done through telemedicine and through the mail. Something as simple as that. But then I think you could go even further to prevent distribution of abortion pills across state lines, particularly in states that had good pro-life laws. If we controlled both houses of Congress and we could get to a 60 vote, I would be looking at a federal heartbeat bill as the place to start as soon as that child has a heartbeat. I mean, ideally, you would go all the way back to conception, but I don't think we probably would have the votes for that just yet. Those would be some of the places to start.
Yeah, Alexandra, the pills are coming into greater focus. I think to some extent that's really good for the pro-life movement because the pills are so obviously dangerous and the horror stories abound, sadly. But what do you think people need to know that maybe they don't know about the proliferation of abortion by mail and these sort of pills in general?
Well, the most important thing to know, I think, is that these are far and away the most common abortion method now. So chemical abortion is something like 53-57% of all abortions in the U.S., according to Guttmacher estimates. These usually take place before 10 weeks of pregnancy, so very early on. It's something that women administer to themselves at home. Increasingly, kind of as Ryan mentioned, this is something you can obtain via telemedicine rather than going to the doctor in person. And some of the risks of that are, for instance, if a woman has an ectopic pregnancy and doesn't know it, she's not going to find out if she doesn't go to the doctor. She takes a chemical abortion pill and could have very serious complications as a result of that. If a woman's further along in her pregnancy than she knows, doesn't go to the doctor, doesn't have any kind of verification of how far along she is, takes it too late in pregnancy, could have very serious complications requiring follow-up surgical abortion. So this is not this kind of simple, risk-free procedure like Planned Parenthood bills it. But I do think kind of on the positive side, something a lot of people don't know about is abortion pill reversal, which is a safe and thus far, it seems very effective method to halt an in-progress chemical abortion. And so this is something that, abortion providers are fighting tooth and nail when they're required by pro-life states to mention this to women before giving them a chemical abortion. They sue the state, so they just don't want anyone to know about it. But this network of doctors who can prescribe abortion pill reversal methods is definitely growing. So I think it's really important that all pro-lifers know about this and are able to tell women so that if someone's kind of in the midst of a chemical abortion that they regret, they can, at least attempt this method.
For people who might be maybe on the fence about abortion, let's say they've always lived been remembered America as a post-Roe world, what can you guys tell us about the kind of horrors of abortion in a pre-Roe world? Obviously, there were ways to obtain abortions. There were ways to do self-induced abortions. And it was slowly being more and more accessible in different states as Roe approached. But what do you think is important for people to know? I'll start with you, Ryan, about what America looked like before the Roe decision.
Say more about what you have in mind in terms of what it looked like kind of from a life perspective, or if you were seeking an abortion?
Exactly that. So people who might be torn on the fence on abortion and think about, how women were harmed or injured, doing self-induced abortions or getting the back alley abortions. What did that look like?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things to say there is that, all the statistics that you've heard about, 5,000 women dying a year from back alley abortions are entirely fabricated. These are things that Bernard Nathanson later in life admitted to having fabricated the statistic between 5 and 10,000 women a year dying with back alley abortions. And I would also add that the kind of the global experience with pro-life laws today, that if you just look at countries that have more protective laws on abortion than we do, maternal health and maternal well-being is better than the countries that have the permissive abortion laws. That it's actually like when people are like, oh no, if you prohibit abortion, if you protect unborn babies, it somehow is going to come at the cost of maternal health. That's not what the global experience shows. It actually shows that you protect both. By prohibiting abortion, you're both protecting babies and you're protecting maternal health. And so I don't think we should succumb to the temptation to think that, you know, prior to Roe v. Wade, America was this like terrible backwards place. And I would also just add one last thought is that I think there are 47, Zan, correct me if I'm wrong with this, 47 European countries, and it's 43 of them have abortion laws that are more protective of unborn babies than the Mississippi law that, you know, is the case before the Supreme Court in the Dobbs case. And no one's suggesting that those European countries are backward nations or that they're unsafe for maternal health, et cetera, which just shows that, you know, the global experience, the historical experience, is that we can protect both.
Anything to add on that point, Alexandra?
Yeah, just two quick thoughts. One is, if I remember off the top of my head, I think it's 39 out of 42 European countries that if they allow elective abortion at all, they limit it to the first 12 weeks. So we often hear, you know, the left is always talking about how much they want to be like Europe. But when it comes to abortion, they don't at all want to be like Europe. I think most people in America would be very happy with a 12-week restriction. Obviously, pro-lifers would want to keep going further than that. But that would be a fine status quo to start with. And the left will not even go there. But I would also add on the point of kind of the pre-Roe horror stories that we hear, this is the first thing people start talking about, abortion supporters start talking about when we talk about getting rid of Roe, as if, you know, women were dying by the thousands. They actually cite, you know, claim that it was thousands of women. And even the Washington Post has had to acknowledge that's just simply not true, because if you look at actual data, it was something like, you know, 150 women per year. And of course, that's tragic. We don't want anyone to die in an abortion procedure, but every abortion procedure kills an unborn child, and women were not dying by the thousands before Roe. So I think this is just one of those kind of fear-mongering tactics that they like to use to avoid talking about the substance of the issue.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. And Roe was itself decided at a very different time in American history. And opinion has shifted since then. Science has shifted since then. So as you guys have been sort of looking back on the last several decades working on this book, how do you think an America without Roe, how do you think how do you expect the country to sort of react, or the question of abortion, you know, being litigated at the state level, how do you expect that to play with the public? We've got a sort of a preview of that in the last week. But is there anything that you're anticipating that you think maybe people should get ready for? And I'll go to you, Alexandra.
You know, I've been thinking about this a lot, especially in the context of whether the Dobbs ruling will affect midterms, for example. And my sense is the vast majority of people in America don't vote based on abortion. This is not at the top of their mind. Among the people for whom it's a top issue, it's, you know, those people tend to tilt in a pro-life direction. But most people are not kind of what we've all been seeing on Twitter for the last 2 days, right? That's not how they think about abortion. Most people kind of generally might call themselves pro-choice, but do not at all support abortion throughout pregnancy. At most, they would allow it either through the first trimester or in the so-called hard cases, these kind of the rape incest exceptions. That's not where the left is on this. And I don't think we're going to see this kind of rabid, crazy reaction, certainly not in a voting sense, the way that the left seems to be banking on seeing it. And I think they want to gin up this kind of activist rage mob based on falsehoods like 7 in 10 Americans supports Roe, or women are going to be dying in back alley abortions by the thousands, or whatever other lie they have to come up with. But I don't think that's where the average American is on this. I think we all kind of know on a gut level, this is abortion is not a real solution. This is not ideal. And people want to kind of find some kind of policy-based common ground as much as they can.
I think the reason I ended up in journalism is that I'm just so skeptical of absolutely everything. It's like a reflex. And so when the good folks over at MyPillow offered to send some towels my way, I was immediately skeptical. I thought, there's so much hype here. Can they live up to it? Nothing beats the feel of a luxurious towel when you step out of the shower. And I'm telling you, this is not scripted right here. These really work. They're very, very absorbent. I got them in a nice blue color, so you can also wrap yourself in nothing but the best with the My Pillow towel set. Other towels feel good but don't absorb, or they absorb but they're scratchy and just don't feel good. Every My Pillow towel is made from proprietary technology that makes them highly absorbent and soft to the touch, but without that lotiony feel. Plus, with a 60-day money-back guarantee, you can try them for yourself and return them if you're not fully satisfied. Made with cotton grown here in the U.S. and available in a variety of colors, each towel set comes with two bath towels, two hand towels, and a washcloth two-pack. So for a limited time, get the MyPillow six-piece towel set regularly $109.99 for only $39.99 with promo code Federalist. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. You'll also find deep discounts on all MyPillow products, including the MyPillow mattress topper, MyPillow Giza Dream Sheets, and so much more. Get your six-piece MyPillow towel set for only $39.99 today at MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist today. Yeah, and you know, Ryan, do you have thoughts on the let's go to the subtitle here, how abortion harms everything. I was looking actually at a paper Janet Yellen, of all people, had co-authored back in 1996. And she's not the only one who's written and studied this, but about how legalized abortion, normalized abortion, led to the end of so-called shotgun marriages, which I think is a way too pejorative term for what was a healthy norm. And not to say it didn't go into some bad places. But anyway, all that is to say, it actually led to a rise, social scientists have found, in out-of-wedlock births. And the same goes for the proliferation of easy, accessible, affordable contraception. So again, as you guys have been sort of looking back, what does, you know, what could change in a country where there is no Roe decision that states fall back on? Is there any way the sort of sexual dynamics in the country are affected by this more broadly? What do you think?
Yeah, great question. If I remember correctly, we cite that paper that yes, Janet Yellen wrote, and it's co-authored by her husband George Akerlof,
right?
And she discusses, I believe the phrase was the feminization of poverty, because what abortion did was it allowed men to abandon their sexual partners and their children, because it now said if abortion is a woman's choice, that means the choice to have a child is also the woman's choice and therefore the woman's obligation, right? And so I think one of the things that we could look forward to as a positive development, and more than just looking forward to, we actually have to work towards this. A colleague of ours at EBPC, Erica Bakiaki, last year published just a really excellent academic book titled The Rights of Women, Reclaiming a Lost Vision. And what she points out is all of the original feminist thinkers, especially in the American context, were pro-life, right? There's a reason why the Susan B. Anthony list is named after Susan B. Anthony, right? She not only fought for women's suffrage, she was also a pro-life activist. And many of the kind of leaders of the women's movement in America understood that abortion wasn't just bad for babies, it would be bad for women. And then, you know, Erica points out that this is a lost vision. She bookends it. She opens it with Mary Wollstonecraft, and then she closes it with Marianne Glendon, the pro-life Harvard law professor. I think there's something to be said for working towards a better vision of womanhood. Whether or not I realize the word feminism can be divisive, so you know we don't need to necessarily use that word, but there's a lost vision of women, a lost vision of the vocation of being a woman, of being a mother, being a wife, that abortion is predicated on the concept that the male body is the norm and that the female body is somehow a defective version of the male body. And so for women to be equal to men and to engage in sexual relationships as men, to engage in educational opportunities as men, engage in economic opportunities as men, they need to sterilize their bodies. They need to view their unborn children as intruders, as competitors, as threats. And a post-Roe world really gets us an opportunity to work towards a culture, an economy, an educational system that says the female way of being human, the female way of being embodied, is a fully equal way of being human as the male way, but they're different. And equality doesn't mean sameness. It means taking both ways of being embodied seriously in our law and in our culture and in our politics. And so I think that's something that we should look forward to, and we should work towards that. And, you know, and I would recommend Erica's book to our listeners. Zan and I, we quote from Erica extensively in our own book, but I think that's going to be another important road for us to make advances on.
Alexandra, same question to you, and just sort of with even more framing, you know, in the same way that Roe had these ripple effects that were, you know, unexpected to many observers. That's a word that Yellen and her husband use actually in this Brookings paper. Will the reversal of Roe maybe have ripple effects that are unexpected as well?
I'm sure that it will. It's hard to predict what they are. I think it's fair to assume that some of the trends we've been talking about might reverse or not go totally back to the way they were, but move in the opposite direction. And it's just generally true that when you restrict abortion, abortion rates go down. That it just, that's how it works. So I think we'll certainly see abortion rates go down. I don't know if that's going to lead to a culture where there's more family formation, or, you know, higher marriage rates, or, you know, less, fewer out of wedlock births. I mean, that's hard to predict. But I do think if kind of the legal restrictions, the legal protections for unborn children are coupled with the types of cultural efforts pro-lifers have been making for decades now, and if we intensify those in response to the kinds of laws we want to see put in place, we very well might see kind of little growth in a culture of life. And that's a very hard thing to affect, I think, but that really is ultimately what we have to do if we want to have a pro-life America. And we talk about this a bit in our conclusion, but none of this is sustainable without a culture of strong families, strong marriages, husbands and wives who commit to each other and, you know, commit to raising their children and, you know, raising children who do then go on to do the same thing. That's really the America within which abortion becomes unthinkable, right? That has to be our goal. So I think, you know, ending abortion is really only the first step towards that.
Yeah. And so just the last question that I have to both of you is just, again, focused on that subtitle, Harms Everything. And I know last time you guys were on the program when the book was first announced, we really talked through what that means and why you guys were so intentional about talking about abortion in that way, this sort of very whole, you know, perspective on the consequences of legalized abortion. And I want to ask if you're, as you're looking forward to perhaps in America after the Dobbs decision, if it looks like what Justice Alito drafted back in February, and you're also sort of looking back on the last several decades, is there anything that stands out in your mind or that has been most moving to you as you have sort of brought this wide angle lens aperture to the abortion conversation? And I will start with you on that one, Ryan.
I mean, I think some of the most moving to me stories are two. Stories of women who, you know, were pressured into abortion but didn't succumb to it, right? And by pressured, I mean maybe like literally, you know, a spouse, a boyfriend, a mother, a father, a boss was trying to coerce them or, you know, put social economic pressure on them into having abortion. They felt that they were alone. And then, you know, they chose life. And sometimes they chose life because, you know, they encountered a pregnancy resource center. They encountered something like Mary's Shelter in Virginia, the Sisters of Life, and just how beautiful these stories are. And we quote a couple of them in the book. And I find those incredibly moving because it's, you know, these were people who they didn't sacrifice their child's life because they thought it would be difficult. They sacrificed their own lives in various ways. I mean, parenthood is a sacrifice, and they were willing to make that sacrifice for the sake of their unborn children. And then the other thing that I would say, and we also quote a story like this, are the parents of children with disabilities who frequently are pressured into aborting their children. You know, the doctors say, oh, you know, the test came back and your child has this condition. You know, when can we schedule the abortion, as if it's already a done deal? And I think I find it incredibly moving, you know, as a relatively new father myself, for, you know, both situations. But I think particularly in the case where the parents are told, you know, your child's going to have this life-limiting condition, everyone would be better off if you just have the abortion, and the parents say no. And the joy that those children bring to the family, to the other siblings, to the parents, but then also a huge part of life is about sacrificing for those that we love. And I find those stories to be incredibly moving and very inspirational, right? They make me want to be a better father when I read stories about other families, rising to difficult occasions.
What do you think, Alexandra?
Yeah, I would just add kind of a third category of stories, and this will tie it back to kind of the opening of your question about our subtitle, and that is stories of women who had an abortion and suffered as a result. And obviously that's horrible. I wish that weren't true. It's not uplifting to read those stories, but it was actually through thinking about women who regretted their abortions that this the idea for this book and the subtitle and the argument of the book in particular kind of congealed for me, because I think, there are a lot of women out there who have abortions and say, you know, this was the right thing for me. It wasn't the right time. I can have children later and that's the best thing, or it'll be better for my relationship or my work or whatever other reason. And I felt like I was confronted with stories like that a lot. And then on the other hand, these, you know, horribly moving and difficult stories of women who really suffered after thinking that was going to be their experience. And then it just wasn't. They had, you know, either physical consequences or psychological or relationship consequences that haunted them sometimes for decades. And I was thinking to myself, you know, how could it be true that women's experiences are so different like that? And must it not also be the case that even women who feel relieved must at some level be harmed by what happened? And I think pro-lifers are very, very good at making the, you know, every unborn child, deserves the right to life case. And that's essential. I'm glad we're good at it. But the case against abortion is actually a much broader case. And I'm really, really convinced that this is devastating to everybody, perhaps most of all after the unborn child, the mothers who go through with it.
The book is tearing us apart, why abortion harms everything and solves nothing. When do you two expect the book to be released?
So it's scheduled for the end of June. And I mean, as far as I know, nothing with, you know, this week's leak is going to change that publication date, just because with all of the supply chain problems, getting paper and glue and ink and then distribution, you know, this is the date. So I think June 28th is the official release date. And Regnery is the publisher, and they say everything is going according to plan.
So it's another casualty of Biden's supply chain crisis. But the good news is that you can pre-order it right now. Again, it's Tearing Us Apart, How Abortion Harms Everything and Solves Nothing. Ryan Anderson, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Alexandra DeSantis of National Review, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Of course. Well, you've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We will be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.